That to-do list you have needs one more thing. Chill. It's an easy thing to do. Just crack open an ice-cold Coors Light and chill. Take the afternoon off and binge-watch anything. Go to happy hour and stay for a couple hours. Who's counting anyways? Or hang out with just your dog because you've had enough human interaction this week. Whatever you do, do it with a Coors Light. Mountain Cold Refreshment made to chill. 2020 Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado. Celebrate responsibly.
Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
Well, I am back in action, but I also have the hiccups. I don't know if you have ever heard a sports radio show that's got hiccups with it. I had a knee surgery yesterday. I am back in action. About this time yesterday, I was under the knife talking to the surgeon and the nurses at the surgery center where I had it done about sports radio. We said we should have been live from the operating room. I don't know if their insurance would have let that happen or mine. But I'm back today. I just want full disclosure. I am sitting in a chair with two large bags of ice on my left knee. Arthroscopic surgery yesterday, my fourth knee surgery. We're not going to talk about that on today's show too much, though, aside from the hiccups and also a little TV dinner talk. TV dinner, Stephen Vaughn, did you have a positive or negative association as it pertained to TV dinners growing up?
Positive for me. I mean, you know, we didn't have the most money growing up, so it was always like TV dinner was like a treat.
It was a treat.
It was summertime. You know, my mom would take us to Winco, and me and my brother could choose out, you know, a TV dinner or two. And it's like, you know, she'd go do something during the day or go work, and me and my brother would stay home and cook TV dinners. Like, that's what we did, you know?
I got to be honest. Same thing in our household. It was viewed, forgive me for the hiccups, it's just going to happen until it doesn't happen. But it was a treat, and my parents didn't get it because my parents were like, "You want a TV dinner? Like, what's wrong with you?" But to me, it was romanticized. It was romanticized by the fact that at the time when I was a kid, that we had television commercials that featured TV dinners. The Hungry Man dinner, in fact, the Salisbury steak Hungry Man dinner. It was a thing, and so I can remember as a kid. Literally, you know, getting jazzed about the idea of a TV dinner as my parents were like, we're not eating that. So the other night, Anna asked me, she said, after your surgery, because you can't eat before the surgery because you're going out, you're going under. And so they told me no food after midnight and then no liquids after 6 a.m. So I could have coffee in the morning or whatnot, or water. And then, I ended up... by the way, the hiccups are a side effect of the pain medication, which I am weaning off of. But I am like in the 1% of people who, when I take any kind of pain medication, like Percocet or whatnot, I get the hiccups. I tried to tell the doctor. I said, I don't need it. I just need regular Tylenol. It's not even worth it. After a while, the hiccups are more of an annoyance than the pain itself. But here we are. So anyway, let's count how many hiccups I can have in the opening segment. Anna, last night, I go into the surgery yesterday at about 2:15. I report to the surgery center. I'm working Twitter pretty hard while I'm waiting to go under the knife. And so Anna ends up going over to Safeway. And she says, what kind of TV dinner do you want? And I said, it's got to be a Hungry Man. You got to get Salisbury steak and whatever else they have, like I remember it when I was a kid. And so in the end... we ended up with Anna walking around the store, apparently, carrying six Hungry Man dinners. And she was terrified that she was going to run into someone she knew. So she was like, she was embarrassed. Like she said, you know, she has some friends that are like fitness and diet nuts that are really strict about, you know, what they eat, what they put into their body, which we all should be. And here's Anna running around the store and she's carrying six Hungry Man Salisbury steak dinners because I said get extras. And so that we'll have her talk about it when she comes on, but we'll have to see how that all went down. In the meantime, we're going to start today's show like we start every show these days.
Three random things.
Get ready.
Number one.
Do you like that? Do you like that? Or do you like, I have three different versions. That's number one, number one.
Number one.
Or that. Do you like that one? Or?
Number one.
Oh, wait, that was the same number one one. Here's number three.
Number one.
Which one do you like better?
I like number one, number one.
Number one, number one. Okay, so going with number one, let's start there. Bo Nix, where's he going to go in the draft? Daniel Jeremiah has his final mock draft out. He has Bo Nix moving to number 22 and ending up where? Here's Jeremiah.
A couple things. I don't believe they want to take a quarterback at 12. So you're able to trade back, get a little value there. I also don't believe that the acquiring Zach Wilson is going to preclude you from taking a quarterback. So I am trading back 22. I am taking a quarterback out of Oregon and Bo Nix. This is someone that just feels like a Sean Payton quarterback. When you watch him, quick decisions, accurate, take care of the football, all the checklist of a Sean Payton quarterback, CD, you see it here with Bo Nix.
Bo Nix, he has at number 22 to the Denver Broncos. Steven, the over-under right now on the board for Bo Nix is sitting much higher than that. It's at 32. Where do you see Bo Nix in this draft?
Yeah, 32 and a half. So, you know, first round, 32 picks. Is he going to be a first-round pick, basically? And right now, he's favored to be a first-round pick. John, I don't see it. Like, I like Bo Nix as a player. I like him that he works so hard. He's very understanding of all the offenses. I don't see that he has the special ability to be, like, a franchise-changing guy. He's already 24 years old. I think that goes against him. He doesn't have, like, a great arm. I know he says that he has a better arm than what people have seen, but I haven't seen it. We've watched him the last 2 years. Like, he doesn't really throw the ball down the field. It was very dink and dunk. I think that could work in the NFL, but to spend a first-round pick or even to trade back into the first round, if you're the Broncos, you know, trade back and then trade back up or whatever it is, like, I don't know. I don't see it. I don't see him as a first-round pick, but the NFL, we've seen so many years, there's this quarterback hungry. They're going to take quarterbacks. Bo Nix just doesn't seem like that guy. Like, I can see Michael Penix because he can throw the ball down the field. Yeah. He's not afraid to do it. Bo Nix just doesn't do that, so I don't see it, John. I think he goes outside of the first round. I think he's a day two pick, top of the second round. But we'll see what happens. I'm excited to see because it's a fascinating story of, you know, a guy that went from top quarterback prospect to not even considered in the NFL. And then last year, you know, probably considered a fourth round pick. Now he's a borderline first round pick and almost ending his favorite to be a first round pick.
The only thing that fits about this for me, and Daniel Jeremiah has the Broncos moving back from 12, trading down to 22. The only thing that fits for along these lines for me is the fact that the Broncos need help. That after the Russell Wilson trade from a year ago and all the assets that they gave up, the Broncos have holes at multiple positions. So it does make sense to me that, you know, Sean Payton, if he wants a quarterback, he can move back a little bit. He can pick up extra assets. But a pretty complex move there from Daniel Jeremiah, having a team trade back and then take the player that everybody says that they would take at number 12, or that, and the problem the Broncos have is they don't have a second round pick. So we'll see what happens there.
Number two.
Like that. Reggie Bush, obviously overjoyed to have his Heisman Trophy once again, but the USC tailback, former USC tailback, held a news conference atop the Los Angeles Coliseum today. That's where he played before he went on to the NFL and played 11 years. He had his three kids with him. He had his wife with him. He had his mother with him. He praised the Heisman Trust for the reinstatement, had the trophy there, but he says he will not drop the lawsuit against the NCAA. He's suing the NCAA for defamation. He filed that lawsuit last year. Everybody thought that he just wanted the trophy back. Nope. Bush says he wants his reputation back. He said, quote, "It's more about being labeled a cheater. The trophy being taken away from me was painful, but being labeled a cheater, far worse." Stephen Vaughn, is Reggie Bush being petty, or is he going after what he justifiably deserves?
No, he's going after what he justifiably deserves. I mean, this was back in, what, 2005? Something like that? Like 20 years ago? I mean, the fact that he's still the Heisman Trophy, you know, the people come out and they give a little tweet about O.J. Simpson, who was a alleged murderer when he dies, and they claim him. They weren't claiming Reggie Bush. Like, it just is, it's wild to me that it took this long. If I'm Reggie Bush, no, I'm keeping the lawsuit on. I should have been reinstated a long time ago.
Yeah.
And luckily, you know, they're finally making the right choice, and they're putting Reggie Bush back in there, giving the Heisman back. I wouldn't hold it. I'd hold all the grudges if I was Reggie Bush.
You'd be petty as all.
I would, yeah.
Yeah, you go Yusuf Nurkic on this one. Look, I think Reggie is right to be angry. It's been a long time. He got vilified, and he's probably sitting around right now, and he's watching all these players collect on the NIL front, and he's going, hey, wait a minute. Like, you know, what happened with me back in the day would be nothing compared to what's going on in today's world. In fact, he'd make more money. But, you know, the defamation thing, I have to know, what are the damages to Reggie Bush? Sure, he got labeled a cheater. He didn't get his Heisman Trophy, but did it cost him money? Did it cost him endorsement deals? Like, he's going to have to show two or three different things here to be successful. Very hard to be successful in a libel or defamation suit. You've got to prove that they said something that was not true. You have to prove that they had malice intent when they did so. And then you have to prove that there were damages. And so I'm kind of wondering, you know, it wasn't like NFL teams didn't pick him after he got labeled, a cheater. It wasn't like NFL teams didn't, you know, he didn't get endorsement deals, or maybe he didn't. I don't know. But I'd have to know more about what the damages are to Reggie Bush before I could say whether or not he is wise to do this. Or maybe he just wants, they pay him a dollar and they say, hey, Reggie Bush is not a cheater. We were wrong. I think the Heisman Trust pretty much announced that by giving the trophy back to him this week.
Number three.
John Fanta had a great tweet today. College basketball broadcaster on Fox said he talked to a high major coach on the state of college basketball. He said, quote, the coach is telling Fanta this. It's a bleeping disaster for veteran coaches. This is not what we signed up for. I'm not mad at the kids one bit. They're seeking their value, earning their money, and I think that they should. It's right to get paid. I would do the same thing they're doing. Anybody mad at the kids is foolish, but shame on the NCAA for not seeing this coming years ago and for being proactive, not having a boundary or a system in place, not having regulations. These collectives are going to get coaches fired. We do not have a break. Nobody in the country has had one single day to sit down and breathe. It's unhealthy, end quote. He goes on and on, but how much truth to what John Fanta is quoting? You know, it's not unlike what we saw from Dana Altman. He's come on this show and talk about it. Tom Crean has come on this show and talked about it, you know, and you can hear it you can hear the pain in the voices of the veteran coaches when they are sort of talking about how the game has changed, how recruiting has changed, how there is no time off. And in the end, you look about what's going on and you think, gosh, this is a terrible thing. This is a big change, and it's not good. Here's Altman.
Oh, John, with transfer portal, a lot of those guys have agents. It's a lot of times the first contact. They call us and say, hey, we've got this kid, and his name's in the portal. Are you interested? So, you know, the agents are out there shopping them around. And, again, that's really been a big change for me. And, the money that's involved and that is, it's just a big change. You know, for 40 years that I was doing this, the worst thing that could have been said about you is that you bought players. And now, you know, that's part of the equation.
Former Oregon State guard Jordan Pope announced on social media last night he's headed to Texas. Speculation, I'm being told the NIL market for Pope is landed around $500,000 for the year. Texas has given him $500,000. He also had a similar offer from Texas A&M. How much of a problem is this, Stephen Vaughn?
I think it's huge. I think it's a huge problem.
Hiccup.
It just distracted me right there for a second.
Sorry.
No, it's all good. Jordan Pope, look, really good player, right? Like, we saw him at Oregon State. We saw him be a really good player. But $500,000 for a guy like Jordan Pope who, yeah, he's going to be a really good player at Texas. Is he going to be an All-American? No. Like, that seems like a lot of money, and I'm all for these kids getting money. I've never been against it, but we have to change the completely our mindset when it comes to college sports then. It's not college sports anymore. It's professional sports. It's a minor league system for the NFL and the NBA. And I think that's what these head coaches didn't sign up for. They signed up for college basketball. Now, there needs to be maybe a limit of how many transfers kids get. It can't just be open season every year where they're just free agency after one-year contracts. I think that could be changed somehow. But the NCAA has to step in and do something. But I have no faith in the NCAA, and I don't know that it's going to ruin college sports. But it makes it so it's not the college sports that we grew up watching. And that makes me a little sad because that's the one I love to watch. I didn't want to watch professional football, professional basketball. I knew those guys were better. I liked watching the college atmosphere, the fans, the pageantry. Without that, we're not going to get that as much anymore. So it does bother me. And I just feel like there's got to be some type of cap on what these kids are going to get. Like Jordan Pope, $500,000. It's great for him. Great job by him. If I were him, I'd do the same thing. He's not worth that much money.
No, and I'm told Oregon State gave him an offer that they thought was a market value offer, but it wasn't $500,000, clearly. And also, he's looking around going, hey, I want to win. And he has a chance to go do that at Texas next year. He hasn't won at Oregon State with any kind of consistency. I think the portal creates two problems. One, it's that free, it's that unrestricted free agency every year. It's problematic. Second thing is, I think it puts coaches in a really bad problem when you've got a bunch of individuals who are coming onto your roster and maybe not coming together in a cohesive way. Tom Crean, former Indiana coach, talked about that on this show.
If you're taking kids in the portal and they're older and they have a set way on doing things and they don't want to buy in and learn what you're doing, if they've been in an environment where they've not been pushed, they've not been driven, maybe where the style of play is completely different, it can almost set you back. Because the one thing you don't want to do is you don't want to sign independent contractors. And it's really easy to look at all these situations now with NIL and the portal in that way, but you've got to get people that have still been raised to a degree on team, on fundamental basketball.
There you go. It's problematic. Even when you're doing it right, it can be problematic. You can get guys that have their own agenda, have their own mission, need the ball, aren't interested in what you're doing as a team. I think it's really troubling.
Well, and as we're talking, Jalen Wells at Washington State, he just entered the transfer portal 11 minutes ago. That's just all Pac-12 honors. Like, he's a really good player, but he probably looked around at the state and said, look, I can get some money somewhere else now. Some team needs me. So it's just, I don't know. I don't mind all the transferring, but it's kind of, it's on one hand, it's a little fun to get the free agency feel, but at the same time, like, I do want a little bit of, I want guys to stay the same a little bit. Like, limit the transfers, the number of transfers you can have in your career. Like, there's some guys that have transferred more times than actually played in college basketball at games. And so it's getting out of hand at this point.
Mick Cronin at UCLA. Here's what he says about the portal.
Yeah, I think it's just different. It's, you got to look at it as different. You know, the dying words of every successful business is somebody sitting there saying, well, this is how we've always done things. And I would remind that to the new head of the NCAA. They better heed those words if they want the NCAA to exist and continue. They better heed those words. So I'm glad you asked that question, because players getting paid is coming.
It's coming. Will it be better, though? Feels like it will be better in some ways, because at least you would have the ability to have players under contract. You don't have that right now. You have two windows to transfer in football, one that's ending here on April 30th, and, that's the second window. The first window starts in December, and, there's two opportunities for your team to fall apart. Here's John Calipari, who this is, obviously, before he goes to the tournament with Kentucky and has some problems with the, in the opening round, and then ends up at Arkansas. But here's where he was on the portal last spring.
It's a little bit of a cluster right now. We need, and it all falls, Dan, it all falls on coaches. It's not falling on college presidents. It's not falling on ADs. It's falling on coaches. I just talked to a women's coach, and he said one of his girls left and got money to go to the other program. It's happening in women's basketball.
Well, we saw that with Louisville. They just lost their best player, Van Lent.
And then I was talking to Jimbo Fisher. I said, what's happening in football? He says, oh, my gosh. So there's got to be some guidance where this the guardrails of what we do. But I said this from the beginning. All of this is going to help Kentucky. Kids are going to want to transfer to Kentucky. We're going to be able to put the best stuff together. I'm not sure if it's the best thing for college sports or college basketball and coaches. Many mid-level coaches are going to get fired because their best players are leaving.
Yeah.
And then they have a struggle year and another struggle and they're gone. I mean, it's not great for the profession. I don't think it's great for the kids.
All right, so there they are talking last spring. And Haley Van Lith is now gone from Louisville to LSU, now going to TCU. And Calipari's no longer with his school. You're seeing some adjustment already. Now, earlier this week, I sat down with the University of Oregon president, John Carl Schultz. Now, Schultz told me it's not going to be this way forever. He anticipates that this thing is going to get back on the rails, but it's going to take the next shoe to drop, he said, would be the lawsuits. House versus the NCAA and other lawsuits. So keep an eye on that. I think it will course correct, but I think we're in a time right now that unfortunately should be a forgettable time in NCAA history, and it's not. There's just so much going on with realignment, the ACC, lawsuits, transfer portal, NIL. It's a very complicated time, and the biggest problem I'm having with it is that it all now starts to feel too much like real world, like our regular lives. Like we're not getting the escape that sports is supposed to be. Like, you know, it's like I'm hearing people say, I'm sick of this. I need to find a different escape. And, you know, I think it will correct. I think we're like a year or two away from the portal getting some, you know, uniform contract, collective bargaining, players limited to one transfer per, you know, a certain period of time, collectives being, more closely regulated by the NCAA. I think it's all coming. But this time right now, it just feels off the rails, and I don't know if you're enjoying it or not enjoying it. I'm not as much as I used to. All right, coming up, we're going to talk about Oregon Ducks. We're going to talk about their draft, their spring game coming up. Zachary Neal, USA Today, covers the Ducks. He'll be with us next. Leave it here.
Well, you can simply watch my game as I've gone simply eighth grade on. Every year I've gotten better. Every year it's been something different. What's often lost is quarterbacks are often a product of their environment and their situation. Those who say I'm a finished product, they really hadn't watched the product.
There's Bo Nix, University of Oregon quarterback, soon to be picked in the NFL draft. Up next, Zachary Neal. From USA Today, covers the Oregon Ducks, does a fantastic job doing it. You can find him on Twitter as well, at Zachary C. Neal, joining us. Zachary, Bo Nix in the draft. What have you been thinking about as it pertains to his NFL future? What's best for Bo?
I think what's best for Bo might be a little bit different from what fans want or maybe what Bo wants. I mean, Bo wants to be as early of a pick as possible. He wants to be an established first rounder. I think what's best for him is maybe going somewhere where he can sit for a year, somewhere like later first round, maybe second round. I would love to see him end up where like the Los Angeles Rams, where he could sit for a year or two behind Matthew Stafford, develop under a great offensive coach like Sean McVay. I mean, I think that would be perfect for him. Of course, he wants to be somewhere where he can play right away, and I don't blame him. I think he'd be successful there too, but if I'm wanting what's best for Bo, I think he could continue to develop a little bit more and then wait his turn a little bit.
What do you think that, you know, people have been talking about him, the most unfair rap on Bo Nix, that, you know, what's the narrative you hear that you just shake your head and you go, I've seen the guy all year. That's not the problem.
I think everyone says, I mean, it's the classic thing. He's the check down king. They look at his completion percentage. Yeah, broke the college record for highest completion percentage in a single season. Say, oh, he only throws less than 5 yards down the field. It's like, yeah, he does that because that's what Oregon's offense asked him to do. If they asked him to throw 10 yards down the field, if they asked to throw him 15 into that intermediate range, I think he would have done just fine doing that. Oregon's offense was set up to where they wanted to get the ball out of his hands quickly and into the hands of playmakers because they had those playmakers all around the roster. So, that's the biggest knock on him, I think. Everyone says that's the low-hanging fruit when you talk about Bo Nix, but I don't know. I've seen his arm a lot. I've seen him air it out a lot before, too, and he does really well at that, too.
Zachary Neal, our guest, USA Today, covers the Oregon Ducks. Who else are you thinking about as it pertains to Oregon players and, you know, in this draft?
I mean, looking at the top, you love to see Jackson Powers Johnson and Troy Franklin, obviously. I'm very curious to see where someone like Bucky Irving goes.
Yes.
You know, he's an interesting type of prospect. He's not big. He's much more powerful than his frame, like, than you'd give him credit for. He has such good contact balance and rarely gets taken down by the first defender. We saw a great career out of him at Oregon. I'm very curious to see what he does at the next level and what kind of team takes that chance on him, and even what role he fills at the next level as well. He's just someone, I haven't heard about him too much in this pre-draft process because he probably is a fringe third round, probably fourth, fifth round player. But I'm just so curious to see what he does at the next level.
Let's talk about Jackson Powers Johnson. I mean, he's a guy that obviously was at a focal point of Oregon's offense. He may be the highest drafted player if Bo Nix doesn't go early, if he slips down a little bit. But Jackson Powers Johnson, you know, a lot of people looking at him as a center or a guard at the next level.
Yeah, that's the thing. He's so versatile. I mean, he was someone that, you know, Oregon put them where they needed him to, you know, early on in his career. He played guard. He moved around that offensive line. He got the chance to start at center for 1 year, and he was the best center in the nation. First ever Remington Trophy or Remington Award winner at Oregon, first ever in the Pac-12. So it's kind of established that he is an elite, elite player. I've seen it seems like his draft buzz has cooled off a little bit since the combine or since the pro day. People thought that he was an established first rounder. Now he's more, you know, late first round, maybe early second. But I think whoever gets him is just going to get a really, really good player. My podcast co-host Jonathan Stewart, obviously Carolina Panthers, great. He is begging the Panthers to draft him because he just wants someone like Jackson Powers Johnson on their front line, can play any position you need, and he's going to be around there for, you know, 8 to 10 years at least.
Troy Franklin, you hear a lot about Marvin Harrison Jr. and Roma Dunze and some others in this draft, but I think Franklin's going to be a really good value for somebody picking in the second round, possibly, who could get this guy. You know, how far away is his game from a Dunze and Harrison Jr. in your mind?
It's interesting to see because he, you know, he's as talented as those guys. He may not be as physical as those guys. I mean, he is long and a little bit lean, but so fast once he gets the ball in his hands. Those other guys, Marvin Harrison, Roma Dunze, they're your established, can be in the league, a wide receiver one tomorrow. You know, I'm not sure that the same can be said about Troy Franklin. We need to see a little bit more. We need to see him be a little bit more physical. I would love him more if he added 10 pounds of muscle and could kind of build out a little bit more, but I think the ceiling is really high with him because we saw what he did as the wide receiver one with Oregon. Super speedy, twitchy, great hands. I love his upside.
I'm thinking about the draft and how, you know, I remember at the Heisman Trophy ceremony, you had Brian Kelly of LSU up there with Jaden Daniels, and he was just beaming, and I thought, gosh, he's really enjoying this. He's going to use this to sell recruits. Is the draft a sellable asset for Dan Lanning, or does he have enough to sell between Oregon, the Big Ten, the Division Street? Does he need a high draft pick to hold up tonight to be able to say to recruits, hey, I can get you to the next level?
I don't think he needs it by any means, but it absolutely is the cherry on top. I mean, you've got everything that Oregon presents and what they can do for players at the college level. And then if on top of that, you can say, hey, look, we've got, if they have a first rounder tonight, it'll be their fifth year in a row that they have a player selected in the first round. And even if they don't, they'll have, you know, multiple selected in the second round and third round. There's probably six or seven guys at least that are going to get drafted this year. So Lanning can sell that. We both know that he knows how to sell that. I don't think that's any concern for them. But yeah, if they're able to say, hey, look, we're a first round factory here. We're building like what we did at Georgia, what Lanning did at Georgia. I think that's all the better for him.
Zachary Neal, USA Today, Ducks Wire, covering the Oregon Ducks. Spring game Saturday, Autzen Stadium, big concert afterwards. But I'm really focused, Zachary, on Dylan Gabriel. I want to see this guy. I haven't seen enough of him. I want to see him in Will Stein's offense. I want to see what he looks like because, you know, this is a guy with 49 college starts who could break Bo Nix's record for 61 college starts if everything goes right for Oregon this year. What are your expectations from Dylan Gabriel?
You're saying that you didn't see enough of him in those 49 career games already, John?
Well, I need to see him in this offense. You know, I always hesitate, and maybe it's a little bit of like, you know, we see Cam Ward leaving Washington State for Miami, and I'm going, okay, I got to see him with Mario Cristobal before I can believe this. But I think, you know, I'm interested to see Gabriel and see what he looks like in an Oregon uniform.
I'm with you. I'm very curious to see what he can do with these receivers and with this offensive line specifically. And then, yeah, when you throw in that he's running a Will Stein offense, I think it's going to be, you know, fantastic. I honestly am much more interested to see Dante Moore. We've seen, like I said, we've seen 49 games with Dylan Gabriel. We kind of know what he brings to the table. Moore, I am just so curious to see what he does with the same thing with these receivers, with this offensive line, with this Will Stein offense. We saw him at UCLA. He had 9 games. He threw 11 touchdowns, 9 interceptions. You know, he was decent for a true freshman. I want to see where that growth was and what he looks like at Oregon. I know a lot of fans are very curious as well because he does represent the future in Eugene. I mean, he's going to be the guy next year once Dylan Gabriel's gone. So it'll be a really nice glimpse to see early on what he can bring to the table.
Yeah, and I saw him play one game where he wasn't good. You know, I can't remember. Yeah. It was maybe Arizona or Colorado. I can't remember which game it was. He really struggled. And I thought to myself, gosh, this, you know, it was the Washington State game. And I thought, gosh, you know, for all the hype, is he just not meshing in Chip Kelly's offense? And so Dante Moore with Will Stein, I think it would be a whole nother endeavor. Do you expect Gabriel's the starter, or you go into the spring game going, if Dante blows it away, maybe there's a competition in fall camp?
I don't think so, really. I mean, every coach you're going to talk to and every player is going to say, oh, yeah, they're going to hype up the competition in this because that's what you need to. And in the day and age of the transfer portal, yeah, everything's a competition. There's no starter in spring. Everyone's competing because you keep them on your roster. I'm not going to say that Dante Moore is going to threaten to transfer anytime after just coming this offseason, but I don't think there's too much of a competition. If you were going to put, you know, a percentage chance that Gabriel's the starter, I'd put it like 95% chance. And Dante Moore, maybe he blows everyone away and he's got a 5-10% chance of starting this year. But I don't think that it's really up in the balance too much. I just want to see both of them play and see what they both can do.
Last year in the spring game, I remember going in saying, I want to see defensive identity from Dan Lanning's defense. And then all we saw were like 50-yard passes from Bo Nix to Troy Franklin and everybody else, Tez Johnson. And it, what, you know, the defense in this spring game, is there anything they can do here that you know, will give you an idea of what they're going to be come fall?
I don't know that you really can see much, because if you do see a dominant defensive performance, then all the fans leave and say, oh, crap, our offense isn't very good. So I think it kind of behooves the coaching staff to be like, all right, let's let the offense show a little bit, and then the fans can feel really good over the summer months. But what I would love to see from the defense is the secondary improvement. I want to see Jabbar Muhammad, Cam Alexander, Kobe Savage go out there and make some plays and show that. I mean, we knew in those Washington games last year, the games that Oregon lost, it was largely because of the secondary and their inability to hold up against elite receivers. If we can see, I mean, even if we see a ton of offensive performance and success, just a couple of turnovers or batted balls or just, you know, havoc plays from the defensive line, get some of these young edge rushers after the quarterback. I know they won't be able to actually sack them, but get pressure on them. I think that would be good to see. But then again, I still want to see the explosive plays from the offense. But, you know, if we leave Saturday and we're talking all about the defense, I think that might be, I wouldn't say a problem, but, you know, something to talk about going forward.
What's the goal in year three? Because Dan Lanning, you know, he goes from winning a bowl game in his first year in the Holiday Bowl to a Fiesta Bowl win and a nice season, except for the Washington games last year. In year three, where's the trajectory for Dan Lanning?
the expectations are high. I mean, going into the Big Ten, obviously their goal is to compete for that Big Ten championship. And if we're being honest, this is a pretty good year to be one of the better teams in the Big Ten, because you've got a down Michigan, you've got a relatively, well, I won't say down Wisconsin yet, because they're, I think they're on the way up, but, you know, Wisconsin's not as good as they could be. Ohio State's going to be something to reckon with. Washington down. I mean, there's not a ton of really great contenders in the conference. So I think their expectation is absolutely make it to that conference championship game. If this team does not make it to the college football playoff, the new expanded version, you know, I think that's kind of the bar in my mind. I think that's probably what they're aiming for as well.
Now, you know, Zachary Neal covers Oregon basketball as well. Zachary, you know, we all saw the images of Matthew Knight Arena kind of sanded down, that Technicolor in, deep in the woods court gone. And what have you found out about what is going to go on with the court? What are they doing?
I found out that I think a lot of Oregon fans are pretty happy that they're going through a redesign. And I'm personally the same way. I've been vocal about it over the past few years that, you know, that court was not my favorite. I'm glad they're going through a redesign. You know, I think that over the next, you know, several weeks, it will probably be completed. I think their goal is to finish that new redesign in early June. But they're...
Lost your phone there. He's just getting to the good part where he was going to tell us about the court. And he dropped out there. We'll see if Zachary Neal comes back on here.
You got me, John?
Oh, you're back. Okay, so you're just about to get into the good stuff. What is it going to look like? I've been hearing more green, less of the less noticeable trees. What are you hearing?
Yes. What I'm told, they're going to try and brighten the image up. I think it was, you know, when you watched the product on television, it was a little bit too dark. And granted, when you saw it in person, it was better looking and it wasn't as bad. But I think they're going lighter trees, lighter wood, getting a little bit more green in there instead of brown. That's what I hear. I don't know. What are you hearing on this?
Yeah, I heard that the yellow was going to go away. It would be less. It would be more green, and that the trees were going to be less noticeable. So toned down. I remember when the court first came out. Do you remember you couldn't even see where are the half-court lines? Where are the three-point lines? It was on television in particular, it was really hard to see that.
Yeah, and it was too distracting. I mean, it didn't look like they were playing on a basketball court. It looked like they were playing on an art mural. So
yeah.
I know that the legendary Tinker Hatfield and Nike creative director Todd Van Horn are designing this. And so, you know, put all your trust in them. I don't think they can go wrong there.
Yeah, well, let's see. And you're right, though. Nobody is unhappy that they're changing this court. So that'll be a good thing. All right, spring game ahead. Follow him on Twitter. Read his work, USA Today, Ducks Wire, Zachary Neal. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Good stuff there. Bo Nix, where will he be picked? You know, some people have him in the 20s. Some have him in the second round. I'll be honest, I did not see him as a first-round guy until I saw this last season. And then I thought, gosh, if there was a team that needs a very experienced quarterback who's very accurate, who is smart, who's a little older, that's not a bad combination for an NFL team. And I'm thinking now about a guy like Brock Purdy. Steven, do you think a guy like Brock Purdy helps the narrative on Bo Nix, because Brock Purdy started 50 games at Iowa State. The Niners throw him in there after, you know, going through the whole Trey Lance, Jimmy Garoppolo, who can play? And in the end, you end up with Brock Purdy, Mr. Irrelevant, and people go, gosh, what a hidden gem. Well, the truth is nobody at Iowa State, and frankly, nobody at Oregon who lost that Alamo Bowl to Iowa State, was surprised by Brock Purdy.
I think it 100% helps a guy like Bo Nix, even a guy like Michael Penix, who has been in the college game for so long. I just hesitate to think that this is going to work out when you're drafting 24-year-old quarterbacks and you're going up against 18, 19-year-old defensive kids. Like, it's such a difference when you're going against the NFL guys. And I think there's a reason why a lot of times these guys have to stay in college for so long is because they weren't going to be first-round picks, but all of a sudden they put up a really good season, and now we're going to say, hey, they're a first-round draft pick. And by all accounts now, Bo Nix looks like he's going to be a first-round pick this year, like based on the betting odds. So I don't know. I think Brock Purdy.
We shall see.
I think Brock Purdy's helped out these guys a lot, and I think that's the easy one to go with is just say, hey, look, well, Brock Purdy, final pick in the draft. Anybody can do it. But I think that's kind of like what we said with Tom Brady back in the day when he was a sixth-round pick. Well, you can find your franchise quarterback in the sixth round. Well, not very likely.
We'll get in depth with what they're saying about the draft picks coming up. Plus, Anna will be along, and the NFL draft right here on 750 The Game. First round coverage starting at 5 o'clock right here on the station you're listening to. Leave it here. You got the BFT. Punch and audio coming up. We'll have the best sound from all around. Best sound from all around. Punch and audio coming up. Ross Dellinger, Yahoo Sports, on tomorrow's show, Friday, tomorrow. We'll also talk about the NFL draft tomorrow. I had an interview with Carl Schultz, the president of the University of Oregon. Play some snippets from that on tomorrow's show. Bring you right inside that room. I met with him at Johnson Hall, which is the from the movie Animal House, the room where the horse got scared to death, if you know Animal House. So I was on double secret probation, sitting with the president at the University of Oregon, and we did about a 40-minute interview. We'll play the nuggets from that interview on tomorrow's show. If you want the full transcript, go to johnconzano.com. Pretty interesting couple of tidbits in there, but I think there's something added when you hear it in his words, in the intonation, the inflection in his voice. Anna coming up in hour number two, because there is no hour three of this show. Hour three is the NFL draft starting at 5 o'clock right here on 750 The Game and whatever station you're listening to. That brings us to our big splash. It's the one thing you need to know.
This is the one thing you absolutely need to know today.
Look at it. Where? Down there.
The Big Splash! Brought to you by Keller Burger, home of the Peanut Butter Pickle Bacon Burger, and voted best burger 5 years in a row. Keller Burger, the burgers your mama warned you about.
Well, I remember in April of 2020, we were all talking about it, experiencing the NFL draft from home. Remember, it was on Zoom, and their players were all in their homes, and the way we watched it was different, and I rather enjoyed that shift that year. Well, the NFL draft this year is in Detroit. And Steven texted me a photograph. Brian McCarthy, NFL's PR guy, basically took a photo of 150,000 people on hand in Detroit 2 hours before the start of the draft. It looks like the longest line for Black Friday. They were giving away TVs that you could ever foresee. It is quite a spectacle, the NFL draft, of course. But the NFL draft, in particular, drawing 150,000, 200,000 people to Detroit just to stand outside and hear people's names called, doesn't do it for me. I'll watch it from home. Thank you very much, like you are. But Stephen Vaughn, what do you make? I mean, this speaks volumes about the NFL.
I mean, it shows why the NFL is king, right? Like 150,000, and that's 2 hours before the actual draft starts, John. It's one round. And what exactly are you watching? You're watching a guy walk up and say somebody's name, and then that's it? I mean, I don't know. Maybe it would be different if I was a huge NFL fan that had a team that I just fell in love with and I loved it all the time. But I don't know. This seems like an event that I would not want to go to. And to stand around with 150,000 people, just shoulder to shoulder, just seems very uncomfortable for me. I will be happy watching it from home on my couch, flipping between that and the NBA playoffs. That seems like a much better time than standing around in Detroit with 150,000 other people.
9 years ago, Roger Goodell, in the first round, butchered the name of Marcus Mariota.
With the second pick in the 2015 NFL Draft, the Tennessee Titans select Marcus Mariota, quarterback, Oregon.
And it is Marcus Mariota in Hawaii. This will be potentially the longest private flight taken by any number two overall pick. The Eagles draft band at the draft party. The Titans fans are all excited. The Eagles fans, are they don't know what to think. Now maybe you could put the Sam Bradford jerseys up for sale now.
Marcus Mariota, said Roger Goodell. The draft always brings, I guess, moments like that. Some good moments, too. But for the players, I have to think that the run-up to the draft, the incessant criticism, the nitpicking, the measuring of their hands, the intelligence scores, the sifting through their lives, I have to think it's not the greatest experience. Justin Herbert went on the Dan Patrick Show in the run-up to the 2020 draft and talked about that.
It's tough. You have to have thick skin, and I think it comes with the territory of being a quarterback and going through this process. But if it doesn't come from someone that directly has an impact on me, like Coach Cristobal, Coach Arroyo, or even my parents, then I don't give too much credit to it. And I think that's pretty important because there's so much being said about everyone at any given moment. And you got to find out what's important and what has value and what doesn't. You have to separate them like that.
It's such a mature outlook. And it's an outlook that I think that a lot of people on social media don't quite grasp. The noise, the criticism, the never-ending siege of people who are attacking athletes, players, even each other to a certain extent. I certainly cannot imagine what it would be like to be a high draft pick in the NFL draft and have the constant criticism. Punch It Audio coming up. Well, I've thrown a couple of quick polls up on Twitter at John Canzano VFT. Bo Nix in the first 25 picks? Yes or no? Vote now. Roma Dunze, drafted? You pick his draft position. 1 through 5, 6 through 8, 9, or 10 plus? Check it out on Twitter at John Canzano BFT. We've got a great action-packed hour of radio for you. Anna will be along. We'll also play Punch It Audio. Steven, I want to get your take on a couple of NFL draft things, but before we get to all that, I think you kind of answered the question. Bo Nix in the first 25 picks. A lot of the pundits believe he will be a first-round pick. You say he will not be. So far, the early vote, 58.8% of the people voting say no, not in the first 25 picks. So we'll see what happens there. Roma Dunze, though, where does he go? 1 through 5, 6 through 8, 9, or 10 plus?
I voted 9, John. I voted 9. I think if the Bears keep that pick at 9, you want to provide something for Caleb Williams. And I know they went out and they got Keenan Allen. They have DJ Moore. They have a good offense. But you go get Roma Dunze. That guy is going to be a baller. You combine him with Caleb Williams. I think it's even an offensive lineman or it's Roma Dunze. So I think Roma falls to 9 and the Bears pounce on him. I think he's the best receiver in the draft.
Herm Edwards saying Jaden Daniels reminds him of Randall Cunningham. This draft is expected to be a draft that starts with Caleb Williams and Jaden Daniels and Drake May and, Marvin Harrison Jr. or whatnot. And then the draft, does it start at 5? Is that where this draft starts?
Yeah, 5 o'clock.
No, but number 5,
oh,
the pick.
Yeah, 5 o'clock and 5. Yeah, five and 5. That's what it starts at.
But, the top 4 picks are going to be, it's going to be Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, probably Drake May, probably Marvin Harrison Jr. And then at the 5th pick, it's, is it Joe Alt? Is Adunze get picked? Is it J.J. McCarthy? Is it J.C. Latham? It kind of feels like number 5 pick is where the question comes.
It certainly seems like that because I don't see how the Commanders are going to trade the 2nd pick in the draft. I think they're locked in to either Jaden Daniels or whatever. It would be a little bit of intrigue to me with the Patriots at 3. There may be a team that wants to get, maybe it's Drake May or J.J. McCarthy that hop up and get them, that really want them. I think the Patriots would be open to trading back and, getting more players in, because you've talked about this before. Like, the Patriots need guys on their team. They just need a better roster.
They need bodies.
They need bodies. And so it makes a lot of sense maybe. So I would say maybe it starts at 3, because if the Patriots draft, I think it's going to be Drake May. If they don't draft, I think it could be numerous of guys. It could be Marvin Harrison, because we know that the Cardinals want him at 4. So if someone really loves Marvin Harrison Jr., hey, make a trade with the Patriots. Get the 3. Patriots can move back. You can move them and get the quote-unquote number one receiver in the NFL draft.
I think the NFL, obviously, is king. But I think the interest in the draft in particular has been fueled this year by the fact that I think there were a lot more eyeballs on college football this last season. The ratings for the college football playoff certainly showed that. I think people know the players. They're staying in school longer. You've got some older players like Bo Nix and Michael Penix Jr. that might have come out earlier if not for NIL deals. So I think all of that is fueling a lot of extra attention on this draft. We'll see how that manifests itself. All right, let's play some Punch It. Let's do it.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Well, let's start with the Bears at number 9. Caleb Williams expected to go number 1 overall to the Chicago Bears. He was asked, who would he take at number 9 if he were the Bears? Punch it.
If I was picked number 1 of the Bears, I'd probably go Olufoshanu because I know he put his life on the line for me, protected me. And then, I'd probably go one of the top 3 wide receivers. Whoever's there at 9, you know?
Whoever's there at 9. He first gave a shout-out to his former high school teammate, played at Penn State, offensive tackle. Then he went, whoever's there at 9, probably one of the receivers. But, you know, it feels like this is Roma Dunze if you're scripting this out. But you don't know what's going to happen between 2 and 9 that could tip this thing on its head. Someone could come up, try to draft a Dunze, turn this thing on its head. Somebody else could be available who was not expected to be available. A lot of inflection points in this draft, and it certainly starts, I think, right around number 5 where you start to get questions about what happens. Daniel Jeremiah, talking about quarterbacks. Who does he think will be a home run? Who does he think might struggle in the draft? NFL Network analyst Daniel Jeremiah. Punch it.
I got the opposite question of who do you think is going to be a home run? And my answer is always, well, who does Minnesota get? The situation really matters there. Who might not work out? I would say that the situation I would be worried about most is probably New England if you get rushed onto the field. I know Elliot Wolf got upset about that, and he's pushed back and said he thinks they have the infrastructure to support a quarterback. I mean, I was there calling the Charger game last year, Dan, and they didn't score a point, so maybe I'm jaded on that one. They've got some work to do.
Yeah, look, I'm looking at this and going, the quarterback, I think, that will be a home run, I think it's going to either be Penix or Caleb Williams. The quarterback who could potentially struggle, Jaden Daniels is the easy pick for me there. Steven, do you have an answer there?
Well, I think the only home run is Caleb Williams for sure. I think he's by far the best quarterback far and away, and he'd be the number 1 pick. I think J.J. McCarthy is a very safe pick. I think he's going to be a very good NFL quarterback, but if you're the Patriots, you kind of need more than J.J. McCarthy and his high floor. That's the question to me, John, is the Patriots are so bad talent-wise. Do you go out and you try to get the quarterback first and then fill in around him? Or do you trade back and try to fill out the roster and then hopefully you figure out your quarterback maybe next season in the NFL draft?
I try to make the team great, then find the quarterback, unless you have a no-brainer. If you've got Caleb Williams, you take him. But I don't think, and this is why these teams drafting 2, 3, 4, 5, I look up and, you know, a lot of years it's the same teams that end up at the top of the draft. And you go, hey, it's no accident. You're just guessing. You're stabbing in the dark. Maybe you're a young coach or a young GM who's trying to, you know, hitch your wagon to, a potential star player. But time and again, what we see is from teams that don't panic, from teams that play the draft as it comes, who look for value, those teams tend to rise in the standings. And, you know, it's just weird to see a team like New England picking where they are, because for years we have seen them be patient and be able to afford to go out and get players. 49ers certainly have, over the years, been that kind of team, unless they move up and do something radical. But I think the better play is to stay put or to move back and pick up value. But these teams won't do it.
Do you think if Caleb goes 1, Jaden Daniels goes 2, and the Patriots are on the clock, but they don't get a trade they like, so they're going to hang on to the pick, would it be smarter to pick a guy like Marvin Harrison Jr. or a guy like Drake May, where there are questions about Drake May as a quarterback, right? Like, I don't think it's a slam dunk at all, where I think Marvin Harrison Jr., you know he's going to be a solid player. Would it always be smarter to pick a guy like that over Drake May?
Yes, it is. And I'll hold this evidence up. We've been talking a lot about the 2021 draft. You know, we talk about Trevor Lawrence. Okay, he's still with the team who picked him. But, you know, Trey Lance isn't. And, you know, and Justin Fields is not. And Mac Jones is not. And, you know, five quarterbacks picked in the first round in 2021, four of them no longer with their teams. Guess who got a $112 million contract today? Penei Sewell, offensive lineman, picked sixth in that draft. Like, the better value, the better player was the Pro Bowl tackle who's got great athleticism and versatility. He was an easier pick. He was a safer pick. He was a better pick in the end. The Detroit Lions are better because they didn't do what everybody else was doing in that draft. They went out, they got their quarterback, obviously via trade. They had Matt Stafford, then they trade for Goff. You know, it's been interesting to watch teams panic. We're going to see it again today. Teams are going to panic. Moving on. Let's go to Chris Sims. He thinks Bo Nix and the Broncos are a marriage made in heaven. Punch it.
The Raiders and the Broncos can't leave the draft without a quarterback. The Broncos need a starting quarterback, right? The Raiders don't, like, they're not desperate, but they kind of need it. And Michael Penix is an incredible talent. I mean, incredible. And so is Bo Nix. And that, to me, when I keep saying that, is like, I don't give a damn what anybody tells me. Sean Payton is going to take Bo Nix. I would be shocked if that doesn't happen.
I see it as well. But I see it, and it's so obvious that I go, How can the rest of the league let this happen? If Sean Payton knows that's the guy for him, how does the rest of the league make it, let it happen? I think the comparisons with Drew Brees are pretty apparent. But to me, it more comes down to the fact that you've got a quarterback who had a lot of starts in college football, has a lot of tape, who has created a pretty safe floor and a pretty obvious ceiling in the NFL. And I think on the right team, Bo Nix is going to be a guy who plays a long time in the league and will play in a bunch of playoff games. And with the wrong team, I think he gets lost. So I think this is interesting to see develop, because it's as much about the fit, and we all know it, as it is the player. Trevor Sikema of Pro Football Focus talking about the quarterback that he is most concerned with. Punch it.
I'm a little worried about Jaden Daniels. I am. I think that there is a infatuation with what he can do as a runner, but it's not exactly what every running quarterback brings to the table, right? First and foremost, I think he has to protect himself, right? If you're going to make the most out of that rushing ability with him, you've got to be able to protect yourself a lot better than how he protected himself even last year. I mean, it's like this guy was on a WWE highlight film getting thrown off of a cage sometimes when he was running and scrambling for first downs, and it's just not going to work at the NFL level. We've even seen that with guys like Lamar Jackson and Josh Allen have to protect themselves a little bit more. And so I'm a little bit worried about that with the durability.
Look, I agree about Jaden Daniels. I think he has the biggest risk at the top of the draft. I think Jaden Daniels is going to get somebody fired. We'll see what happens there. Tosh Lapoy, Oregon Ducks defensive coordinator. It's been 27 months since Oregon's coaching staff has been on the job. They got a spring game Saturday, Autzen Stadium. Here's Tosh Lapoy, the D coordinator. Punch it.
It all starts there with talent acquisition. So now our job to develop that talent and then retain it. And we're in a much better place we were 27 months ago coming here. So that was our goal, you know, to each room really. And that's not going to happen overnight. So, you know, started assembling that more to what Coach Lanning and myself is used to from a standard standpoint up front, you know, and then build this thing, you know, in layers, and think that we've certainly take some huge strides towards that direction of, you know, establishing some depth, you know, really at every position.
Oregon's better. Oregon's deeper. Is Oregon better, though, with its coaching staff? I think it's a fair question. Dan Lanning, I think, has got tremendous trajectory, and he has a chance this season to take the next step. What is that next step? Well, it's not losing to Washington. I think they'll get by Washington. But But it now becomes winning the game against Ohio State, winning the game against Michigan, winning a Big Ten championship game, doing some things he hasn't done before. I think the players are better. I think now the focus is going to pivot a little bit at Oregon to coaching.
But the question I have, John, is the roster is definitely more talented, but is it talented enough to play a Big Ten style? It's a different style than the Pac-12.
Yeah,
like,
it is.
Is the roster fit to play that way?
I don't know. And I was thinking about this, and I wrote about this week, that, you know, you've got an Oregon team that got to the national championship game in 2015 against Ohio State, and you have a Washington team that got to the championship game this last year. You know, you're rumbling towards the Big Ten. But the problem being, like, when you really look back and you think about the rushing totals, 2015, Ohio State outrushed Oregon 296 to 132. That was the game. Ezekiel Elliott and Cardale Jones ran over Oregon, out-physicaled Oregon. So that was a Big Ten team. We went, oh, Big Ten, you know, Pac-12's got to get with it. Pac-12's got to get bigger. All right? That was the first CFP year. Fast forward to this last year. Michigan-Washington. Michigan outrushes Washington 303 to 46. The combined rushing totals, 599 yards for the Big Ten, 178 yards for the Pac-12. That's not an aberration. Those are the numbers. That's an Ohio State-Michigan game, Ohio State-Oregon game and a Michigan-Washington game. You got boat raced at the line of scrimmage, and so I think that is a fair question, the physicality. But I also think, you know, I'm watching Ohio State. They still Oregon's running backs coach. They get Chip Kelly as a coordinator. Is that a better staff than what Oregon's got? You know, if it comes down to coaching, how do you feel about that matchup, Steven?
I think I'd still have to give it to Ryan Day and Chip Kelly. I think Dan Lanning has the potential, but he has to win one of these games. We can say how much we love him. He's 0-4 against Washington, 0-3 against Washington. Like, he's got to win.
0-3.
He's got to win one of these games.
And I don't even put it on Lanning. I think it's more of a staff thing. Because to me, Tosh Lapoy's been a great recruiter, but I haven't seen the defense. I haven't seen a lot of the defense where I leave the game going, man, they really outcoached somebody today on the defensive side of the ball.
But it's always in the biggest spots, too. It's one of those things where they play a big-time game and something unforeseen happens. And you go back to that Pac-12 title game. The offense was off, the defense was off. Everything was off. And it happens in the biggest games. When they play teams, you know, like Oregon State, who were, you know, their coach was leaving and their roster was, you know, in flux, then they dominate. They're kind of the little front runner there. They gotta figure it out against these big-time teams.
And I think they will be. I think they will be okay. But I think it's, you know, I always raise these things, and I don't want people to misconstrue what I'm saying here. I raise these questions because my expectations for Oregon are that they're going to play at the highest levels. And in order for them to play at the highest levels of college football, the coaching is going to, at some point, it is going to come down to, hey, everybody's got great players. Who can put them in position to succeed? Is it Dan Lanning? Is it Ryan Day? Is it someone else? Is it James Franklin, Penn State? You know, who knows? But I think if you hold up Lanning's first 2 years, you hold him up and you go, okay, this is really encouraging. They have great players. They've recruited at a level that never recruited before. They've sold a whole bunch of season tickets. They got a lot of enthusiasm. But I'm also left kind of looking at it going, huh. At some point, if it comes down to Tosh Lapoy in a battle of wits against Chip Kelly, can he win that? If it comes down to Will Stein, you know, in a battle of wits against Penn State's D coordinator, can you win that? Those things are going to matter at some point. And Oregon's staff is young. It's really helped with recruiting, but they're young, relatively inexperienced. So Will Stein was coaching high school football not that long ago. Tosh Lapoy, he's been around, got a great reputation as a recruiter, but is he a in-game adjustment guy? We haven't seen it yet. we haven't had to see it. Or maybe we have, and, you know, Ryan Grubb got the better of him last year in Seattle and also in Vegas. So we will see. Anna's popping into the studio coming up. You got the bald-faced truth. Well, it was a pretty entertaining opening segment of this radio show as I had a case of the hiccups. Anna, you were listening. How bad was it, my case of the hiccups, to start today's show?
What I appreciate is your full transparency. Like, hey, here's the situation.
I know.
I'm on air. Here's why I've got hiccups. What I thought was missing was like a drinking game. So like every time you hiccuped, you know, people could take a shot.
I had this response last time I had a knee surgery. I've had four knee surgeries. Had one yesterday, if you're just tuning in. Yeah, I'm kind of tough. and so I am currently seated in what could best be described as a movie theater style chair that reclines. I would call it a lazy boy but this boy is not lazy. And I have a ice pack that has been on for a while. I lost track of how long it's been on, but it feels good to leave it on. Doctor would say 30 on, 30 off.
30 on, 30 off.
All right, maybe I'll pull it off for a little bit. But
give yourself frostbite.
No, but it feels really good. but I'm not a narcotics person. I'd be a terrible drug addict. I actually told the doctor, the surgeon, I said, I don't mind a little pain.
Yeah.
And he looked at me like, what's wrong with you? But I'm like, I would rather have a little pain than some of the side effects that you get from some of the pain medications.
True, yeah.
So even though, you know, they put me on, I think it's hydrocodone or something like that, okay?
Yeah.
And they said two tablets every 4 to 6 hours. So yesterday after the surgery, I took a half a tablet.
Right.
Then I, like 4 hours later, I took another half. That's me. I get hiccups from it. And it turns out that 1% of people who are given Percocet or whatever that is, get hiccups as a side effect. I am in the lucky 1%.
Yeah, you won.
I'm a 1%er.
You're a 1%er.
Look at me.
Congratulations.
The prime minister is also a 1%er.
The worst part is, as we went to go figure out what you should take this time around, neither of us could really remember which medication it was that gave you the hiccups. Like, we should know that.
I know now.
We know now. Yeah.
And then so I call the surgeon's office trying to say, hey, you know, I'm having a little pain, but I'm mostly on Tylenol at this point. But, you know, it would be great if I could get on something else, or at least have it available in case, like, I take a turn for the worse, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I leave that voicemail, and we've all been through this experience. The doctor's office calls back, and she says, her message back is, I'm not sure if you need it at this point. And I'm like, if I didn't need it, why would I be calling you? You know what I mean? They're just calling to let you know I have hiccups. No, I'm calling to let you know I have hiccups. I probably don't want to take this anymore because the hiccups are worse than the pain. And I would maybe like to see if you could put me on something else. And she finally agreed to do it, but she did not like my tone.
Yeah, well, maybe
she didn't
like
my tone.
Maybe you were a little grumpy.
I asked her. This is how I started the call.
Yeah.
Her name was Ruth.
Okay, Ruth.
And I said,
poor Ruth.
Ruth, have you ever had a knee surgery? She said, no. Jeez. I could hear it in her voice. No.
Oh,
and I said, Ruth, I wouldn't have left you the message if I didn't need the prescription.
Poor Ruth. Ruth's just trying to do her job.
This is what I told her after. I said, Ruth, this isn't your fault.
Okay.
This isn't your fault. I'm just frustrated. I got the hiccups. So,
yeah.
Full disclosure, I don't have the hiccups. And
yes.
I don't really know if I do need the prescription. Like, maybe Ruth's right.
Yeah, maybe.
But I feel pretty good right now.
Yeah.
And I'm just mostly on Tylenol. I haven't had any of this Percocet stuff since last night. And the hiccups seem to have disappeared. They've evaporated.
Well, I'm glad you're not going to wind up as a Vicodin addict. That's all I got to say.
Yeah.
You know? I'm glad you're not going that route.
I just said that to myself while you weren't in the room. I muttered to myself, I'd be a terrible addict.
Yeah.
It'd be awful.
And that's a good thing.
I could not do this.
Gosh, I remember doing stories about like Oxy. I think it was OxyContin was the one that got really, you know, people went nuts on it. Like I interviewed once a guy that was like a successful CEO of a company and I mean, he had like literally was back or knee surgery, was prescribed and he's, opiate or whatever it's called, and then got massively addicted to the point where he was holding up Walgreens, like pharmacies, to obtain this pain medication. And he lost everything. Like, he went to jail, prison, because he just went totally off the rails.
It's not that uncommon a story. We had Chris Herron, the former Boston Celtic, Denver Nugget player, on the show years ago. And I'd cover him. I covered him when he was in college. And he came on the show, and he gave a riveting interview about his addiction.
Yeah.
People's vision of a heroin addict is a guy sleeping, drooling, you know, dirty, you know, but, you know, that's his last day. You know, mine was with the Celtics, and when I started, and you know, I couldn't function without it. You know, I wasn't getting out of bed in the morning. I wasn't going to bed without it. And so, you know, sports and drugs, especially opiates, went hand in hand for me because I wouldn't be able to do one without the other.
He talked about the rock bottom moment for himself being that his second or third child was being born. And he was he left the birth of the child to go get some heroin.
Jeez. Yeah.
And
bad.
When he came back, his wife looked at him and she knew.
Ugh.
And she was like, you know what? We're out of here.
Yeah, that's
she basically stuff. That was rock bottom for Chris Herron. And and then subsequently we had somebody called a show who was driving from Salem, Oregon that day, listening to this radio show, and turned his car around. He was driving from Salem to Portland to go score some heroin. And he heard the Herron interview and he turned around in like Woodburn.
And called in.
No, he emailed me later.
Oh, wow.
And said, you know, I'm an addict. I was in my car listening to Chris Herron's interview. And all the stuff he said just made me really think about my life. And I thought, gosh, what am I doing? Mm. I'm in my car. I'm driving now to go get what I need to get.
Yeah.
And he literally on I-5 turned around and went back. And I ended up writing a column about him. Mm.
That's
and
powerful stuff.
We got in touch. We talked on the phone.
Yeah.
And he, I don't know if he stayed clean.
Yeah.
I tried texting him not too long ago just to see how it was going, and there was no reply. But, you know, it was, and Chris Herron said it wasn't like, you know, he's in the NBA.
Right.
People were looking at him like, you know, you had the greatest life, whatever, but down deep, he was using every day.
Yeah.
And so that was.
No, there are functional addicts right now walking around, driving around.
But you hit on something, because you know you're talking about the person who has had no problem in their life with addiction.
Yeah,
they're living a normal life.
Yeah,
they have a back surgery or whatever, and they're prescribed drugs, and it's like, well, you know, we've seen all these documentaries on the epidemic of OxyContin and whatnot, and how people, I mean, it was a drug that they got.
They
you know,
knew. They knew it was addictive.
Yeah. They knew it, and they got the FDA to put a label on it saying it wasn't. And they convinced doctors to say it wasn't. And then the doctors became addicts.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's terrible. But speaking of which, let's pivot out of that.
Yeah, thanks for joining this uplifting show.
I got a nice compliment prior to the surgery.
How so?
I was in kind of a, you know, it's 3 o'clock. Come 3 o'clock, my biorhythms are on.
Yeah.
You know, I'm on air.
You
3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, right?
Yeah.
So I'm on.
Yeah.
That's my time.
Right. You also hadn't eaten since 6:15
that
in the morning.
That too. But the two nurses who were prepping me for the surgery, shaving my leg, you know, and I said, should I have done that before? And she says, we don't like the people to do it because a lot of times the guys don't know how to shave their legs. And so she shaves my leg because they're going to do the thing. And then the other nurse is like putting on these compression socks and, you know, and I'm just chatting them up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I was very chatty and I was asking, I have good veins. You know, they were doing an IV. I was like, you know, look at these veins. And then the girl was like, yeah, look at this vein on the, like the side of your head and your leg. Like, And I was like, I'm vascular. Okay?
So vascular. Does anyone ever describe themselves that way?
I said, if I wake up from this surgery and you got like four IVs in me, because it was like, oh, look at all these veins. I said, I'm not going to be happy about that. Anyway, they left and then they acted like I couldn't hear them.
Okay.
They were like one stall away.
Yeah, you're only separated by a curtain.
Yeah,
probably.
But they were talking about me. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, do they not know I can hear them?
Yeah.
And the one says to the other, she says, you know, that guy's really personable.
Personable.
And I thought, yeah, I am personable.
Well, I hope they have a conversation with Ruth.
Yeah.
You know?
A little balance for Ruth.
Yeah. Hopefully they know Ruth.
I wasn't hiccuping when I was dealing with them. But I was thought it was kind of a lame question from Ruth.
Yeah.
Because she was like, I don't know if you need these.
Yeah. What I don't understand is why you came up with the cockamamie idea of needing Hungry Man Jack dinners post-surgery.
Yeah, I mentioned this early in the show. Let's get into this.
The fact that you and the girls were hung up on the idea that we were all going to sit around post-surgery.
Yeah.
Last night. Wow, that feels like a long time ago. Last night and eat Hungry Man Jack dinners.
Why is it Hungry Man Jack? I thought it was just Hungry Man.
I don't know. I think it's Jack.
Okay.
I don't know.
This is the thing. Stephen and I talked about this.
What?
Because it's romanticized for us. Because for me as a kid, my parents didn't buy TV dinners.
Yeah. They were too expensive?
I assume so.
Yeah.
Also kind of crappy. But I thought I would see on TV commercials about the Hungry Man dinner.
Uh-huh.
On TV.
Yeah.
And so it became very romanticized in my head. Like, why can't we have TV dinners?
Like, you would just see like the Salisbury steak and start salivating.
That's steak.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want it?
Yeah.
And so I used to beg my mom, can I get a TV dinner? Can I get a TV dinner? And I think she may have broke down a couple times.
Uh-huh.
And it was seen as a treat.
Okay.
Steven said the same thing. They would sit around, they eat the TV dinner.
Yeah.
So it got in my head because I couldn't eat. I was not allowed to eat after midnight. Yeah. I had no fluids, 6 a.m., whatever it was.
Yeah.
And so you said, what do you want to have for dinner? And I was like, TV dinner. I don't know why. But it just, in my mind, that was making it last night, okay?
Well, you know, as your wife, I got to try to make you happy post-dinner like this, and so.
You go to the store.
Yeah.
And what happens?
You know.
I'm getting surgery, you're at the store picking up, and I said get extras.
I did. I'm picking up a 12-pack of ginger ale in case your stomach was upset, and I'm loading up 6 Hungry Man Jack dinners and in the checkout line at Safeway. Hoping that my friends who are like non-GMO organic health nuts don't see me, you know, because they're going to look at me and judge me. They will judge. They'll look at me and be like, what are you doing? Well, this is his post-surgery dinner.
Yeah, but you're just there. All they're going to see is you coming down the aisle. You're carrying 6 Hungry Man full-size Salisbury steaks.
And as it turns out, you ate 2 of them. Yeah.
I would have ate more if you made them.
Steak, Salisbury steak, by the way, what is that? Like, it should have an asterisk. It's not steak.
It's a beef of some kind.
Yeah.
Low-grade beef.
It's definitely
delicious is what it is.
It's delicious.
And the hardest part is getting the darn mashed potatoes warm.
Gotta get it right.
It's like varying items in one tray. They all heat at different levels.
Then you throw the gravy on the mashed potatoes from the Salisbury steak.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, Stephen. There was a moment I finished my... Because I told her, get extras. I said, just get extras. So she gets like 6 of them. And I eat one of them. I'm done with it. And then I'm like, I'll have another. I can't move. And she's like, I got to go warm it up. And I was like, what are you talking about? You got them. You're like Ruth now. Just cook it. Just cook it. What are we saving him for? The apocalypse is like M. Night Shyamalan or something?
The oven's only so big, okay?
Cook them all. All right. I've got some parting thoughts on the draft coming up. Plus, we have the draft right here at 5 o'clock. Well, we've got NFL draft coverage coming up here, top of the hour, 5 o'clock. It'll be the Caleb Williams show right out of the gates as the USC quarterback apparently headed to the Chicago Bears. We'll see that go down. He was asked, as I mentioned earlier in the show, he was asked what position the Bears should target with the number 9 pick. A lot of secrecy around the number 1 pick, number 2. The NFL likes it that way. Why? So you'll tune in. You'll listen in on the radio. You'll tune in on TV. But always, I think it's always cool, even if you know who's going to get picked, to see that person sort of go to the front of the room and have that culmination of a lifelong dream. I've talked over the years about, people always say to me, like, what's the greatest sporting event that you've ever attended, or what is the coolest thing you've ever seen? And my mind immediately, it doesn't go to, like, a lot of the team sports. I don't know why, like, it doesn't gravitate that way. It doesn't go to the team sports. It goes to the Olympics. And the reason why it goes to the Olympics is because I've covered 5 Olympic Games, and it really is true that every event that you go to, every venue, every day, multiple times a day, you're watching this crowning moment, this culmination of all this hard work and all this talent and childhood dreams and all of the competitions and all of the coaches and everybody who, you know, piles into their, you know, pours into this person that is out there competing, whether it is in gymnastics or swimming or track and field or whatever sport it may be, usually an individual sport, some team sports, but it's the individual sports where you know an individual's story. You know what they came from. You know the hardship of their story. You know their journey. You've seen some of it. And sometimes NBC on the Olympics will do a really nice job with the vignettes and kind of explaining to us who these athletes are and where they're from. And it's really cool. And to me, the draft feels the same way, whether it's the NBA draft, the NFL draft. Major League Baseball, I think, could do a better job with its draft. In large part, you know, that draft has so many rounds, so many players. Players are young, coming out of high school, a lot of them, so we don't really know them. But in the NFL's case, you know, we do have knowledge of who Caleb Williams and Michael Penix and Bo Nix are, and you know, some of their dreams and some of their story. And so I think it still is cool, even if we know that USC quarterback Caleb Williams will be the number one pick in the draft, or if it's the worst kept secret in the NFL, or whoever it is in any given year, or, you know, if there's a trade coming, whatnot. But when we see that person get picked at number 1, 2, 3, all throughout the draft to the end of the draft, 7 rounds, it's the culmination of a lot of people pouring into a person and their story. And so I do like that. I think the NFL's done a better job in recent years. I think it started in the pandemic where they started doing a better job kind of telling the story. And I much prefer, I know there's going to be a bunch of players that are there in the green room, but I much prefer seeing the players with their families in their living rooms and those shots that they do. And you can see all their people in the room and the excitement, genuine excitement, in some cases relief, when a player is picked. But Caleb Williams expected to be the number one pick in the draft coming up at 5. The bigger question is what the Bears will do with the number 9 pick. Will they trade it? Will it be a receiver, offensive lineman? That was the question this morning, at least. And Caleb Williams was asked who he would pick with the number 9 selection. And, you know, what position would he go to? And of course, he's a quarterback, thinking like a quarterback would. It's either a receiver or an offensive lineman in most cases. But he was asked who he would pick, and Penn State offensive lineman Olu Fashanu is a former high school teammate of Caleb Williams. He's expected to go somewhere in the 6 to 15 range in the draft. Offensive tackle, big offensive tackle from Penn State, but they played together in Washington, D.C. in high school. So even as Caleb Williams says that's his preference because he knows that he'd put his life on the line for me. That's what Caleb Williams said. He put his life on the line protecting me. And in fact, though, I think the Chicago Bears are soon to find out that everybody's life is on the line protecting Caleb Williams. He will be the franchise. So will Drake May. So will Jaden Daniels. So will Michael Penix Jr. So will J.J. McCarthy, potentially, and Bo Nix, and a whole bunch of others. I did my weekly, that's pain meds talking, Spanning the Globe installment on today's johnconzano.com post. And if you are a free subscriber or a paid subscriber, you got alerted to that this morning when I posted that in real time. If you want to get it in real time, make sure you go to johnconzano.com and sign up for a free subscription or a paid subscription. But a few things I want to highlight that are in there. One of them is Cam Ward. Cam Ward at Washington State. If you ask Washington State fans about Cam Ward and what they think of Cam Ward and what they think of his game at Washington State, you're going to get a real mixed reaction from Cougars fans because they're going to talk about all the great quarterbacks under Mike Leach guys like Gardner Minshew, certainly, and they'll even go back and talk about Washington State quarterbacks from yesteryear, Ryan Leaf, Drew Bledsoe, those guys. But they'll talk about all those quarterbacks who set records and, you know, led the team to improbable wins and even to a Rose Bowl. And but when they talk about Cam Ward, I think the average Washington State fan is going to say, eh, a little underwhelmed by ultimately what happened in his era. Now, I like Cam Ward. I like him as a person. We've interviewed him multiple times on this show. But I saw from a million miles away the move that he was telegraphing, leaving Washington State for Miami. And you may remember he came out on New Year's Day, and he posted that weird video that was 5 seconds long, put it on Twitter, put it on Instagram, and he basically just said, "What's up? It's Cam Ward. I'll be declaring for the NFL draft." And everybody ran with it. News agency, Cam Ward declaring for the draft. Cam Ward heading to the draft. I tweeted January 1st, 9:28 in the morning, quote, "I'll be declaring," end quote, leave some wiggle room for NIL dollars. Because I thought Cam Ward, who got $90,000, by the way, from the Cougar Collective at Washington State, included an apartment, a leased pickup truck, $50,000 in cash. I thought that Cam Ward all along was kind of leveraging Miami's donor collective, trying to get more. Like, maybe his agent was going, they're not offering enough. They wanted seven figures. They wanted exposure, too. And the deal that Cam Ward eventually got, because what did he do? 2 weeks after posting that video, "What's up? It's Cam Ward. I'll be declaring for the NFL draft." You know, he reversed course less than 2 weeks later. Changed his mind. Announced he was transferring to Miami. So they got the number they wanted. I'm told it's seven figures. I reached out to Mario Cristobal today to ask him kind of about Cam Ward's spring game. 19 of 24 passing, 324 yards, 3 touchdowns. And I said to Mario Cristobal, "Give me the early word on Cam Ward." And Mario Cristobal offered me 2 words. He said, quote, "Alpha dog," end quote. Now, that is the most Mario Cristobal quote ever. But I think down deep, Mario Cristobal wants Cam Ward to be the alpha dog. Because we know his personality. I think Cam Ward's got some of that it factor. But I thought that Washington State was at its best under Cam Ward when they had Nakia Watson healthy and in the lineup, and they were running the football first. When they became pass happy, it became problematic for Cam Ward. And I don't blame Cam Ward for leaving Washington State for Miami if it's the difference between $90,000 or $100,000 and $1 million. Most of us would make that decision. But I think the bigger move for Cam Ward was maybe just a loss of confidence overall in what he was enduring and seeing and part of at Washington State. Now, granted, he's part of that. He's part of the struggles on offense. He didn't make the throws. He may not be the guy that can sit back there and carry a team offensively. He might be better for a program like Miami, who we all know is going to try to run on first down and run on second down and pass only when they have to on third down under Mario Cristobal. So I think, you know, Cam Ward on his third college, he goes from Incarnate Word to Washington State, now to Miami. I think it's a case of a player using the transfer portal and NIL to elevate his profile, elevate his platform, get him into the right position. I understand it all. And man, did I see through it January 1st, 9:28 in the morning. I went back and looked at my tweet. "I'll be declaring for the NFL draft" is not "I am declaring for the NFL draft." That is a big leap. So keep an eye on that. I also posted a photo today. Go in and check it out if you haven't seen it yet, of Cam Rising and Cam Ward from Pac-12 Media Day in July. I happened to be standing by my radio booth on Radio Row in Vegas, and Cam Ward was there, and we were just talking. And Cam Rising, mostly not limping, you know, he just kind of came around the corner, and he was walking along, and Cam Ward saw him and immediately went into "the GOAT, here comes the GOAT." And Cam Rising, reigning league MVP, 2-time champion, just kind of walked up grinning, and they slapped backs and whatever. But I thought Cam Rising was blushing. Like, he was pretty close. Like, you could tell he was a little mildly embarrassed by what was going on and the attention and all that. And, of course, he was coming didn't play a snap during the season due to the knee surgery, but he gave us a wonderful interview. And just an update on Cam Rising, if you didn't see Utah's spring game April 13th, he threw for 208 yards, two touchdowns, 15 of 19. He looked good. And part of it is he's got a great coordinator in Andy Ludwig. Like, let's not go too far. Because I know Andy Ludwig better, I think, than any coordinator that I have ever watched. And it's just because I have watched Andy Ludwig call games at Fresno State. That was my first stop where I got to see Andy up close. University of Oregon, certainly. Now watching him at Utah. He's really good. And one thing I know about Andy Ludwig is, especially in a situation where he has a quarterback like Cam Rising, he is particularly deft at giving a quarterback a game plan that they can handle. He really does call plays within the capabilities of the quarterback better than any coordinator I've ever seen. Because a lot of times you watch a coordinator and they will call a game in a way that sort of says, let's see if this guy can handle it. I never see Andy Ludwig doing that. I only see him calling plays and he goes, I know my guy can handle this. Let me give him a play he can handle. So I'm not surprised with 15 of 19, 208 yards, two touchdowns. Some of that is Andy Ludwig calling the plays. Check it out. Spanning the Globe weekly installment, johnconzano.com. All right, the draft is coming up. Caleb Williams at one. Where does Bo Nix go? Where does Michael Penix Jr. go? I'm excited to see this because it's as much about fit with these guys as we've been talking on the show today as it is really where they end up. There are no accidents when it comes to success. Want you to leave it here. NFL draft coverage. We're back tomorrow. We'll break it all down. What happened? What does it mean? What do you think of it? The Bald-Faced Truth, not here for a long time, just a good time.